Hello, welcome to Shared Planet. Well, I confess that today I've been driven to drink. I usually refrain from strong liquor whilst on air, but I have in front of me a beautiful bottle of a tawny liquid. And it's got on its label, it's got a picture of a hunter with a dog and a beaver dam in the back, and an unpronounceable name, which I'm going to have a stab at, which is Bavaholt, which I know translates as beaver shout. And this schnapps comes from Scandinavia and is supposed to bring good luck and health to the hunter. And it's composed of alcohol, the bottle tells me 43% worth of alcohol, infused with the secretions from the anal glands of the European beaver. Well, who could resist? So I have with me in the studio Kelvin Booth. Of course, Kelvin, can I tempt you to a glass? Let me just pour you a glass here.
First time for everything.
Okay, I'm going to pour you a little bit. Cheers, I should say.
Skål.
Skål. It's a nice musky smell.
It's a sort of warmish smell.
Well, that's the end of Kelvin Boot.
It has strength.
Now, what is it that is giving? What's special about this drink?
Well, the additive, as you say, musky and aromatic. This is called castoreum, and it's from the castor sacs of beavers, which, as you say, are linked. They're not the anal glands, but they're linked with the anal glands. And as far as beavers are concerned, the castors and the anal glands work together for scent marking. Castoreum, as we've just witnessed in our drink, it's been used as a food additive for at least 80 years. You can find it in foods as diverse as jelly babies and ice cream, where it's part of the artificial strawberry and raspberry flavourings, or as a substitute for vanilla. But you won't see it on the labels. It falls under the generic heading of natural products. And it's been used as a medicine in the past for treating headaches, fever, epilepsy, and as a contraceptive, analgesic and anti-inflammatory, and as an antidote for poisoning. And it's still used as an additive in modern perfume, so it's no wonder the poor old beaver was persecuted for its valuable cargo. But beavers also have fur, and that was a valuable commodity in both the Americas and across Europe. So again, it's no surprise that beavers on both continents were brought close to extinction by hunters. It was estimated that there were only 1,200 beavers left in Europe by 1900, although they've now been reintroduced or naturally reoccurring across much of their former range. And by the time of the last estimate in 2006, the number had risen to 639,000, although it's thought that there are probably many more. And we even have them in the UK. In fact, there's a group living wild on the River Otter in Devon, and there's a pair in captivity and another group in Scotland, which are helping us to understand how beavers might fit back into the wild in Britain.
Thanks very much, Kelvin. Now, the pair of beavers that have been in enclosure in Devon since 2011 are well and truly settled now and have been busy transforming the environment around them. In fact, they've had a remarkable effect on the conditions and look of the whole area. Our Shared Planet reporter Chris Sperring has been visiting them at their base near Okehampton since their arrival and went for an update recently with Peter Burgess from the Devon Wildlife Trust to see these changes in the landscape that they've created.
The last time I was here was probably about 2 years ago.
Yeah, probably 2 years to the day, I think.
Yeah, it feels like very much a similar time of year. Lovely autumnal feel to it at the moment. And this is new.
It is, yeah. The beavers have really started to move into areas that they hadn't exploited before.
This pond definitely was not here.
Yep.
And the channel coming into it is actually quite wide. How long does it take them to actually make this?
Can be just over a space of a couple of weeks, really. They're really impressive engineers. They can move vast amounts of material in a short space of time. But it's really down to what they want to exploit and when. So if they need particular food and they need to use the water, then they'll start digging and making new dams.
But this is still water. It is a pond, isn't it?
It is, yes. They've just created this whole network of ponds all the way down about 120 metre stretch of this small watercourse. So we've just got this almost like a paddy field effect of pond after pond going down the stream. The thing that's benefited beyond compared to anything else, really, is our amphibians, frogs, toads, newts. They've done really, really well. But the dragonflies are really special. Things like black darter, which are only found usually in upland environments, have come down here just off the edge of the moor and are starting to breed within the beaver site.
And you can actually attribute that to the work that the beavers are doing here?
Absolutely. Before, there were just a handful, literally, of frog spawn clumps that we were seeing every year on the site. Now we've got hundreds. It's a dramatic change.
When I first came here, Peter, it was basically a woodland. And what I'm looking at the moment, I can see a vast open area there, which is drawing me in to explore it.
That's right. These are the beaver meadows. These are areas that the beavers have created. They've dammed areas, they've felled the trees. So this is really just the tip of the iceberg, really, in terms of what the beavers have created on the site.
Well, that open area there is really intriguing me. Can we go and have a look? We've got new water here, a new channel through here, Peter. And how have they coped with what's been the driest September in I think, since records began, I think they said?
I think that's right. I mean, it has been a very dry season, a bit of an Indian summer, really. But what the beavers are doing, this is quite soft ground, so they're actually excavating this channel. Yeah, they feel safe in water. Water gives them a means to move material around. So they want to keep open water here. So they dam. And when the dams are not effective in keeping that water back, they'll be digging channels so that they can still swim through the site.
I remember when I was here last time, we were actually looking at the dams. I wonder if we could have a look at them.
Yeah, we've got one absolutely just where you are, where you're stood at the moment.
Oh, I'm actually stood on a dam.
This is a structure that's made from just a lattice work of small willow branches. It's probably about 40 metres wide, I'd say, about a metre high at its highest point. But it is, that sounds huge. I mean, it is a big structure, but it's quite subtle in the landscape and very green, fits in, but it holds back a vast amount of water.
So when we get a lot of rain here, this is obviously going to hold all the water back.
Yeah, this will fill up. So all of that water that will suddenly wash down into this site will be held back by this whole network of dams that we've got through this area. And it's a huge volume. We're talking about only 500 metres cubed just in this one area. So it's about slowing down the speed that the water moves through a landscape. And as it does slow down, it drops a lot of the pollutants that it might have in the water as well.
So, Peter, will the fact that the water is held here during what could be quite a big storm, will that have benefits downstream?
We've got some really impressive scientific monitoring equipment here that will categorically tell us on this site whether we do or don't have good water quality benefits, but also flood benefits as well.
Can we go and have a look?
Absolutely.
Now, you've brought me to a fenced-in area. We've got a solar panel, which is obviously powering something going on in a plastic barrel here.
Yep.
And then below that, we've got a plastic box, which is harbouring a battery. Tell us all about this.
What that's analysing is the difference in the flow between water coming into the site before it meets all the beaver dams and the speed of the water that comes out of this area. So how much do these ponds influence the flow rates of water downstream? And then we can use this information to work out what beavers would do if they were over a whole catchment and not just a 150 metre water course.
One of the things you were saying earlier, Peter, was the fact that the dams are purifying the water, taking the pollutants out. Are you able to look for that as well?
Yeah, we certainly think that's the case. This equipment has got the ability to take water samples, and that's actually looking for a whole range of different potential pollutants, but also the turbidity, the amount of silt that's in that water as well.
Presumably this is all new, so when are we going to be able to see some of the data from this?
I mean, we're getting really good data now, and hopefully, yeah, in late spring we'll be able to get some really good hard and fast results, which will enable us to, you know, use this as an example of what the potential of beavers could be over a whole landscape. So this is just a small 3 hectares. You know, what's their role in potential flood mitigation or water quality improvements when we look at a whole catchment?
Peter Burgess of the Devon Wildlife Trust ending Chris Sperring's report. It would seem that bringing back the beavers is more than simply replacing a long-lost species or a process of rewilding. Bring back the beaver and you bring back ponds and dams. And as we've heard, beavers are expert wetland engineers and so potentially perform a useful function, especially in these times of flooding and extreme weather events. So is it too much to say that the reintroduction of the beaver has a measurable economic value? Kelvin, can we measure the worth of nature in these monetary terms?
Yes, we can, and we're doing it already. It's called environmental economics, and it's really gaining ground in the conservation movement. The idea that nature provides us with goods in the form of food, for example, isn't new. But the idea of services has been less obvious, so increasingly we're looking at nature in a new way and applying terms that sound more at home with economists than with naturalists or scientists. Terms such as goods and services, ecosystem evaluation, natural capital, habitat accounting, value added. These are words that resonate with policymakers and business, that nature has a value and can pay its way, but words that also may imply nature as a commodity that must pay its way and can be traded. Beavers are a great example. And it isn't just beavers. Many aspects of nature contribute. And we've heard on Shared Planet before about the contribution that bees make to agriculture. In the USA, for example, the services provided by pollinators is worth about $6 billion annually. And on the other side of the coin, the loss of India's vultures has been estimated to have cost the Indian economy some $34 billion over a period of 15 years.
Well, thank you, Kelvin. And joining me now are two people who have strong opinions on exactly this subject. Tony Juniper is a writer and environmental consultant who wrote a book last year called What Has Nature Ever Done For Us? Or How Money Really Does Grow on Trees, which looks at the range of services provided by nature throughout the world. And also joining us from Vienna to put an opposing view is Professor Clive Spash, an economist who specialises in environmental economics at the Vienna University of Economics and Business. Tony, why is the assessment of nature in terms of ecosystem services going to help conservation? How does that work?
We've been actively trying to stem the decline of nature for many decades now, with protected areas, with protected species legislation, pollution controls, all the rest of it. And yet, if you look across the world, the list of endangered species just gets longer. And I think this is not so much to do with people not liking nature or not thinking these things are beautiful and should be protected. It's much more to do with the mindset that says we have to sacrifice nature in order to advance economic growth and development. And I think until we can show that nature is essential for economic growth and development, I fear that that balancing act, that trade-off between human needs and nature will continue. And it's a complete misperception. It's based upon falsehoods. And I think the more we can expose those falsehoods, including with economic numbers, then I think the quicker we win all of the arguments, not just those concerned with why nature is beautiful, worth protecting for its own sake, has spiritual values, is aesthetically pleasing, is scientifically fascinating. We have to add to all of that the economic argument.
Clive, what could be wrong with that approach?
I think there's a couple of premises in there already. First of all, that we need to continue economic growth, and that we see development as only being about economic growth, which is basically just throughput of materials and energy in our society without any consideration of actually what economic growth is trying to achieve and what it does achieve. The other side of this is actually to promote an economic valuation approach as if it were independent from morality. Economics is not independent of morality. Economics is actually based on a moral philosophy, and a very particular type of moral philosophy. So what's happening when you move down the economic valuation route is you're actually imposing a very specific type of morals on society. And those are the morals of use, utilitarianism, and they promote the money value. Well, that's what's being promoted here, over and above other types of values.
So Tony, is this reductive, taking it down to preference utilitarianism?
I've been trying to make the moral case for nature for 30 years, and, you know, a small minority of us get it. But unfortunately, the majority still don't, including the economists and the financial planners who determine much of how our society works. I do agree with Clive on the growth question insofar as it is about measurement and what we're measuring. And at the moment, we do simply measure the use of materials and energy and the consumption in societies, when in fact what we should be measuring, of course, is the state of nature, human happiness, human health, the extent to which societies are cohesive and harmonious. We don't measure all of that. And actually, I do think that the economic valuation of nature comes part and parcel with getting better economic metrics. Because once we know the declining state of nature from the point of view of the economic losses that are going with it, then the better we are able to make different kinds of arguments in terms of economic planning. You know, economics is not going to go away. Even if we had a beautiful society with nature at the centre of it, we're still going to need an economy.
So, Clive, it does seem that the argument is that you have to deal with the reality of the corporate business world, like it or not, so therefore we're deluding ourselves not to talk their language.
I'm actually an economist, right? I've been studying economics for 35 years. The way that we're talking about it here is if there's only one type of economic system, and that is just rubbish. Currently what we have is a push for neoliberalism and push for markets. This idea that we can only manage what we can measure, which is being pushed. The idea of metrics, the idea of assessment through monetary valuation. The economy is about creating value in GDP terms. What the economy is currently doing through growth is destroying nature. It's not about including these things so they can be taken into account and protected. What you're doing when you move down the economic route with the current economic system is you're talking about how we can destroy nature and have much more of human artifacts, how we can push nature out, how we can capture values, how we can change the natural system into the economic system. And it's not about a moral case versus some logical economic case. As I stated, economics is a moral system. It has an underlying morality. Let's get that clear. What you're doing is you're imposing a different type of morality on society. What you're saying is what counts and what is good in society is what can be added up in monetary terms, and the highest money number wins. That's what we're saying here.
So, Tony, are you just playing into their hands?
I don't think I'm imposing anything on anyone. I'm kind of looking at the challenge we face and recognise that in our current economic system, there is no moral recognition of our responsibility to protect nature. In fact, at the moment, in the age of austerity, I see the complete opposite, with the case being made by politicians that we have to roll back the protection of nature in order to achieve more of this growth nonsense. I don't think that the allocation of metrics to the value of nature leads us down some kind of neoliberal kind of utilitarian future for nature. I think what it does is it makes visible to society what we're losing as we drain wetlands, destroy forests, empty the seas, pollute rivers. And once we understand those values, we don't have to create some market for nature. What we can do is we can change the law, and we can say it's illegal to do certain things that damage nature. We can change the tax system so that different kinds of behaviour are encouraged. We can change public spending priorities so that more is put towards the protection of nature in an integrated way. And we can change subsidies, including in agriculture and in fossil fuels. All of those things will be more likely once we understand what we're losing. Because at the moment, all we measure is an apparent upside in growth. And nobody has got on any balance sheet anywhere the countervailing loss of nature, which is the price of that. And I think, you know, even if we had a very strong moral dimension, we're still going to need numbers, because there's going to be a lot of people in the future, 9 billion of us, and we're going to need to be able to measure our impact on the systems that sustain us.
Clive, if we don't go down that road, if we don't measure and try and express and interpret the way that we look after nature in economic terms, what's the alternative?
What are the alternatives? The alternatives are to engage with people in communities, to start looking at how we change the planning system, to address the growth machine. I mean, I'm very happy to hear that growth is regarded as a problem here, because it is the central problem. And the growth machine is what needs to be taken on. And why do we have to give up and say, oh, sorry, the corporations are ruling the world now, so let's all just play along with their game until they rule even more of the world? We need to oppose this. We need to actually do something about it. The environmental movement was founded on actually recognizing that this was a threat to nature, what was happening, and opposing it, not playing along with it and saying, oh, well, they're in power now, so we better just do what they say, which is what we've got now. And I'd like to actually discuss, what about these prices? We kept, you know, the mention of prices and pricing. Do you actually understand what a price system is and what a price system does? And where are these numbers going to come from that you're going to calculate, and who's going to calculate them, and what's going to be included? I mean, this is a big area which I've been working on for a long time. I can tell you, calculating those numbers is not straightforward, and also you lose out on much more than you actually put in. People can value beavers, maybe, but can they value all the bits of the ecosystem the beavers depends upon? Because those are important as well. What about all the nutrients? What about what goes on in the soil? What about the microbes? What about the insects? What about all these parts of ecosystems which people don't have a preference about and don't actually care about? These things get lost. That's why we have ecologists. That's why we have experts, so they can actually make some decisions for us. And those decisions need to be made in society, in participation with other people. Once we go down the pricing route, we're not addressing the growth problem.
Two things seem to stand for that. Is one, how do you come up with numbers that make any kind of sense on a practical economic level, let alone a moral level? And two, are you just not collaborating with a system that is doing harm?
On the numbers, there's lots of different ways in which one might look at the value of nature. And I do think it's really, really important to draw a distinction between price and value. What I'm talking about is value. And once we understand the value, there's things we can do to protect it. And very often we don't need to put a price on it. We can say the value is so high that the damage that's being caused to that particular value, that ecosystem, must stop in the interests of society. And, you know, take the blanket bogs on Dartmoor, where there is work underway to repair those ecosystems, which are very important as bird breeding habitats, very important for scarce plants. One of the reasons why that ecosystem is being repaired is because there is a value that's been detected for the supply of fresh water to people in the cities near there. And that fresh water can be supplied in a more secure and cheaper way by protecting the ecosystem, because it means you need less technology. And so you can see an economic value straight away there. Now, that doesn't mean that that is the only value. And one of the things I think is really, really important here, and this is the point Clive makes, which is a really key one, is that, you know, we can't measure everything, and we shouldn't try to measure everything, because there might be some butterflies on that bog that have no apparent economic value now, and I wouldn't try to put a value on them. I would say they should be protected for their own sake. But I think they're more likely to be protected for their own sake if we can show that that ecosystem additionally has a really big economic value for society.
Well, that sounds quite reasonable, Clive. Any problems with that?
When we look at the types of regulatory approaches that come out of this kind of approach, it's not the kind of things that Tony was mentioning, which I do agree with, that we can look at in terms of regulations and restricted areas and these sorts of things. But what's coming through right now is actually setting up of markets. You know, there's a big UN project called the Economics of Ecosystems and Biodiversity. And what that did, very quickly, it moved beyond the idea that we're going to measure these values into a language which is called capturing values. And what is capturing values? Capturing values is about setting up markets. And what are these markets going to do? They're going to trade biodiversity. They're going to destroy biodiversity and then replace it with offsets. Right, this is how development is going. What about ecosystem services? Look at the carbon market, the biggest type of services that we have in terms of financial terms, the trading that goes on there. What's happening with that? It's trading to make profit for polluters and speculators, and doing nothing about actually addressing the fundamental real problem, which is climate change. So what happens when we move down this route is that it very quickly shifts, and the language that is being used for valuation is there to enable markets.
Clive, it does seem that this fundamental difference is what Tony is saying, is that in order to make changes happen now, or at least in a foreseeable future, we need to deal with the situation as it is and talk the language that is currently spoken, whereas I think I understand you saying is that that's a lost cause. It's not going to do any good, and we need to start again from scratch. So how do we deal with conservation that is urgent now?
Dealing with urgent issues now is the best way to do that, to spend several years doing valuation studies, which are then going to feed into an economic process where they're going to be watered down in the hope that we're going to get legislation in 5 or 10 years' time, which is then going to set up some market that's going to trade things, and then we're going to spend, like the carbon system, 3 or 4 goes around doing this. Or do we put political pressure on the system, on the people, to actually start addressing the real fundamental issues? I mean, we spent 20 years discussing carbon, and we've done absolutely nothing to reduce it. That's my fear, that when we go down this route, we've seen it already. And to continue on with this idea, well, we're going to work with the corporations. Do you know, In the top 100, right, if you rank countries next to corporations, in the top 100 of comparing GDP throughput and revenue of corporations, you'll get 48 corporations. That means 48 corporations are bigger than most countries. And how are these corporations run? Are they run on a democratic elected system? No, they're not. They're top-down planned economies. So the majority of our real-world economy is already planned in an undemocratic system.
I was the director of Friends of the Earth for a long time and the vice chairman of Friends of the Earth International, and we used to have these discussions about the radical changes needed in order to save us from ecological devastation. I then, when I left Friends of the Earth, stood as the Green Party candidate in Cambridge, and I discovered that people do not share that view. And in a democracy, and I think most Green people are in favour of democracy, then we need to bring people with us. And the radical idea that we need to overthrow capitalism and start with something else, most people are not prepared to vote for that at this stage. And under the circumstances that I see, with a mass extinction unfolding, a climate catastrophe on our doorstep, I think we have to work with whatever we can to be able to do as much as we can. There may be a collapse in the economic system, which is the other way of looking at this, and then maybe we have an opportunity to then rebuild afterwards. But I think that would be terrible for people.
I think that the problem is that people are already suffering. It's not a matter of waiting for people to suffer.
Well, it's going to get much worse, Clive. It's going to get much worse. If we go anywhere near the climate change forecasts and the ecosystem damage that looks like it's going to happen, it's going to get much, much worse than it is now.
We're both agreed then. We're both agreed that it's going to get much worse and that nothing is being done about it. What we're arguing about here is what has to be done. And, you know, as I was saying earlier, the calculations have already been done that Tony is asking for. You can take a recent report, Better Growth, Better Climate, look at its internal actual figures that it has, not on ecosystems, on human health. And you take the numbers that they have calculated on human health, and it means that every single economy is in negative growth, just on human health. We don't even have to go down putting the ecosystems in. If we put the ecosystems in, we'll be even more negative. The whole thing with growth is that it's a lie.
So what should we do next?
Well, what we need to do is, for a start, to get the environmental movement to be a damn sight more active and not go around saying we must have a price on nature if we're going to save it, which I'm sorry, Tony.
No, the environmental movement doesn't say that. No, I'm not the environmental movement. I'm an independent advisor, and I advise companies, I write, and I think about things. The environmental movement is doing nothing on this except being very confused and having at least five positions at once.
I'm going to ask you to stop there because this could run and run. It's been completely fascinating. Clive Sebastian Vienna and Tony Juniper in Cambridge, thank you, and this will continue. Thanks very much indeed. Well, that just goes to show what an intractable problem this is. There are no easy answers to be had at all, but I bet a lot of you do have something to add, and we'd love to hear from you. You can find our contact details on our webpage, which is bbc.co.uk/nature, and then search for Shared Planet. And I should say that we had an absolute flood of emails and letters as a result of our programme on plastics, so thank you very much for all of those. It clearly touched a nerve. My thanks, of course, to Kelvin Boot. And next week, we ask the question, do we have room to share the vastness of the oceans with giants? As whale numbers are beginning to recover, how can we live alongside these Goliaths as our shipping lanes get busier and busier? Until then, goodbye.